Just a quick word from our sponsor before we jump into today's episode. Optimizing your internal processes can often be a huge unlock for streamlining revenue and getting you and your team, if you have one, out of a manual process. If you're looking to reduce costs and headaches in one fell swoop, consider graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. It's the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, HR into one platform and one source of truth. With NetSuite, you reduce IT costs because NetSuite lives in the cloud with no hardware required, accessed from anywhere, and you cut the cost of maintaining multiple systems because you've got one unified management suite. You improve efficiency by bringing all of your major business processes into one platform, slashing manual tasks and errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move. So do the math. See how you'll profit with NetSuite. Everything seems to be more expensive these days, so proven ways to cut costs and boost performance at the same time, like NetSuite, are kind of a no-brainer. By popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/SPI. netsuite.com/SPI. Once again, netsuite.com/SPI. And now a quick word from our sponsor before we start the show. Ready to earn sustainable income while creating the work you're passionate about? Get started with Memberful. Whether you teach online courses, host a podcast, run a blog, or write a newsletter, Memberful has all the tools you need to unlock revenue and deeply connect with your audience through subscription membership. Their platform allows you to easily gate content, communicate with your audience, and tier membership access directly on your own website. Plus, with Memberful, there's no need to change your workflow. They work seamlessly and integrate with the tools you already use, including MailChimp, Discord, Zapier, ConvertKit, Google Analytics, and more. Utilize their powerful built-in features and dashboards and watch your business grow. The best part? Memberful gives you full control and ownership of your audience, your brand, and your business. Get started for free at memberful.com/SPI. One more time, that's memberful.com/SPI. Hey, thank you so much for taking the time to listen in today. You know, it's been an interesting week here in the podcast because last week we had two episodes come out, one on Wednesday and another one on Friday. And the one on Friday was about me and my videographer's new invention called SwitchPod. You can find it at switchpod.co. This is a physical product. We've never done anything like that before. So if you wanted to hear more about why that exists and how it was put together and a lot of the experimentation that we're doing there, you can listen to the previous episode, episode 343. But this episode, 344, I'm really excited because our special guests are Tom and Dan from Studio Neat. And the funny story about Tom and Dan is that both Caleb and I met them in person and watched them speak on stage at Craft and Commerce, which is the convention and event that ConvertKit puts on. I was a keynote at that event, so I got to meet Tom and Dan. And what's really cool about their business is they create physical products and put them on Kickstarter, and they've been very successful. You may have heard a product or about a product once called Glif, G-L-I-F. This was their first product that did extremely well, which was the very first iPhone tripod sort of adapter, and it made six figures in the Kickstarter world, and they've since created multiple physical products, and they've got the system down. They've got some really interesting techniques. They have some really interesting structures in their business, and they have some very interesting tactics for getting involved with new physical products. They've also had a number of failures as well, which they've come on. They're coming on to talk about in the show. So I just wanted to do a couple things here. One, just expose Tom and Dan to you because they are amazing, generous people. They've had a direct impact on where SwitchPod has gone to. And again, you can check out switchpod.co, which is live on Kickstarter right now at the time that this episode comes out. If you're listening to this in the future and you're interested in physical products, you can still check out switchpod.co to kind of see where we're at now with that. If it was successful, well, hopefully it will be. But Tom and Dan are amazing. They have some amazing approaches to their business. And I wanted to share how they do what they do and what they taught us too to help us with our physical product. And even if you don't have a physical product, this is going to be a great episode because it teaches you a lot about just how to approach different problems that your target audience might have and how you can test things to make sure that what you're about to launch is going to be successful. So thank you for listening in. Let's cue the music, then we'll get right to it. Here we go.
Welcome to the Smart Passive Income Podcast, where it's all about working hard now so you can sit back and reap the benefits later. And now your host. He likes to doodle when he's on a conference call. Pat Flynn.
Hey, and real quick, our sponsor today is Uplift Desk, creators of office furniture designed to help you work better and live healthier. If you haven't tried a sit/stand desk before, this offer from Uplift is the perfect opportunity. Plus, you can support the show at the same time. Visit UpliftDesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. A desk should fit the user, right? Which is exactly why Uplift Desk has a ton of customization options. They're stable, the materials are solid. I mean, just the choices of material alone are incredible, all the way from laminate to eco to bamboo and even solid wood. The option to stand while working is just healthier, better circulation, better movement, which helps to reduce all kinds of different health risks and repetitive strains. And over a million customers have chosen Uplift Desk for their innovative designs, direct to consumer pricing, same day shipping. They can even give you free accessories with every desk. Uplift is a great deal, and they're built to last and include an industry-leading 15-year warranty, free shipping, free return shipping if you need to do that as well. So go to UpliftDesk.com/SPI for 5% off your order. That's UpliftDesk.com/SPI to get 5% off your entire order. Hey, what's up? Pat here with Tom and Dan from Studio Neat. I'm so excited for this conversation today. Tom and Dan, thank you for being on the show today.
Thanks for having us.
I would love to know how this all started, and then we'll get into the how-to, because I was first introduced to Studio Neat at a conference in Boise, Craft and Commerce, which is run by ConvertKit, and your presentation, out of all the presentations that were there, both of you were on stage, was the most inspiring to me, and that's largely due to the fact that, you know, myself and my partner Caleb and I, we were coming out with our own physical product too, and this is what you guys do, and your story and the way you've made it seem so achievable just was really, really great. And as many people who are listening to this now know, we came out with our own physical product, and I just wanted to thank you both publicly for helping us and guide us in the right direction here. And many people have, but just since you're here, I just wanted to thank you both publicly for that.
Awesome. Yeah, well, thanks a lot. I mean, that's why we like speaking and like having a podcast and blog post, because, you know, from our perspective, it's like pretty insane that we're doing what we're doing. So I guess as a little backstory, and this is Tom, by the way, talking, but okay. Dan and I were both living and working in New York City as designers, like kind of just out of grad school. And like full time, and Dan, just the iPhone 4 had just come out, and that was kind of the first like nice camera on a smartphone. Mm-hmm. And so Dan was like, "Man, I wish I had a way to stick this thing on a tripod." And so that was like kind of the first little text message. And from there, we just kind of started making sketches and doing some kind of 3D modeling, like we're kind of used to doing as designers. And then we kind of arrived at this thing that we liked. We thought it was a pretty cool design. We had been able to make some 3D prints, and so we knew it worked, and it was like this physical thing. But we were like, okay, well, this is a cool thing. We wish other people had it, but we didn't know how to get there, right? And we didn't have any way to really raise money. We didn't have any experience being like in business or anything like that. But this thing, Kickstarter, had kind of come out that year. And we hadn't really ever seen like a physical product go big or be big on there before. But we figured, hey, let's try it. So we had a goal of $10,000, and we ended up tripling that goal in the first day. And it was kind of crazy. It was the first big Kickstarter project really for like a physical product before. And it was like in the Apple world. So we got like a ton of press, and our minds were kind of like blown. We didn't really know what we were doing. And so pretty quickly, we were like, okay, I guess we have to make a company now. And ever since, and that was in 2010. And ever since then, we've kind of been doing the same thing where we have an idea for a product we think will be really great or useful for people. And we make it kind of the best way we can, find the best way to get it made, and then release it. And that's kind of what we do over and over again.
That's amazing. I love that story. And Dan, from your perspective, like, what was it like to get just this sudden rush of customers on Kickstarter for a product that really hasn't even been created yet, or a company that hasn't really even been formed yet?
It was nuts. It was crazy. I can still kind of feel, I can remember that feeling of just incredible excitement. I think exhilarating is probably the best way to describe it. It was just so exciting. And, we had kind of a little bit been doing things where like you could write a blog post and maybe it gets picked up by, you know, Daring Fireball or something, and you get a lot of views, and it's like really exciting. Like, wow, all these people are like reading this thing that I wrote. But to have that then kind of translate into actual dollars, where instead of page views, it's just like dollars and customers like ratcheting up and up and up. It was really just tremendously exciting to know that kind of we had hit on something that people were interested in. So that feeling kind of never gets old. For every, you know, Kickstarter that we do, it's just an awesome feeling.
That's amazing. And Dan, how many of these have you, how many Kickstarter campaigns and products have you gone through at this point?
I think we've done 9 Kickstarter campaigns, and then we've also done several products kind of off Kickstarter for various reasons. So in total, I mean, over 20 products, but yeah, we kind of lost count at this point, which is also crazy.
That's incredible. So we're going to definitely dive into the how-to. I mean, you've definitely done this multiple times, so I'm sure there's a lot of knowledge there of things that have worked every time, things that didn't work, and then you stopped doing those things. So we're going to get into that. But Tom, I wanted to talk about that first product really quick, and correct me if I'm wrong, this was called the Glyph, right? G-L-I-F. Mm-hmm. Yep. I was a part of that campaign. I backed it because I needed that thing, and I didn't even make that connection until I saw you guys in Boise, until later in the presentation when you showed the image of it, and I was like, I have that thing. That's so amazing. and it wasn't like a complicated thing either. It was just, it fulfilled a hole in the market for when that iPhone 4 came out. Go through the iterations that kind of at the start, like, okay, you draw it up and then you design it, but like, you know, you didn't have business experience, and I'm assuming you didn't have manufacturing experience. Like, how do you take an idea in your head of just like, okay, I need a thing that holds an iPhone, to an actual physical product?
Yeah, I think we got really lucky. We like somehow picked the best product to ever start with, because it is, like you said, so simple. It's like one piece of injection molded plastic with one like insert in it. So it's kind of one of the simplest things you can make at scale. Mm-hmm. And you know, we got pretty far with the skills we knew how to do, which was like sketching, using some 3D modeling on the computer, and then 3D printing using like a third party service. It was Shapeways back then, which is still great. And so we had these like plastic things in our hand, but they weren't exactly what we wanted. We wanted them to be more rubber and nice. And we had never done anything anywhere like that. I said we were designers, but like Dan was doing UI design at Frog Design, and I was doing like software and some other stuff. So mm-hmm. we had never done anything that interfaced with manufacturing or industrial design. But so we kind of just took a leap. I mean, we knew that injection molding was the kind of piece we needed, and we got some idea about how much money we needed to make that happen. And so that's where that $10,000 goal came from, to make this very expensive steel mold that you need to make these things. But after the kind of Kickstarter blew up and got big, there was kind of these like series of people helping us out. So one of the first one was this guy named Patrick, who, I don't know if you remember Dodo Case, but it was like this iPad case that was like bamboo and like nice materials, and it blew up on the internet, not on Kickstarter, but just it blew up. Mm-hmm. And so he had to scramble and like figure out all this stuff. And he just happened to be in New York, like after we had launched, and he's like, hey, I have a lot of advice for you guys. Like, let's meet for lunch. And so we chatted with him, and he gave us a lot of kind of direction on how to manage this as a small team. And so he told us about like third-party fulfillment, and just kind of gave us some pushes towards some services that would help us kind of like figure that out. So that was like a huge help in kind of grounding us in, okay, like there are some services for this that like can help us out, and you know, we can get there. But then the next huge help came. There's this company in South Dakota called Premier Source, and their IT guy had just heard about the campaign and saw it, and he just talked to one of the engineers of the company, like, hey, we should help these guys out. Like, they probably need help, and this is perfect for us. And they basically, what they do is they like make injection molds, and they do injection molding in South Dakota, in Brookings, South Dakota. And so we just got like a cold email from them being like, hey, you know, here we go. And that started a really great, like over decade relationship with this company in South Dakota, where they really helped us walk through kind of, you know, what we need to do to tweak the design and how the manufacturing works, and then manufactured it for us. And so, you know, the thing we, I think, really learned from that process was, you know, people are such a great help, and it never, like, the best thing to do often is just call, like, just straight up call people, like cold call manufacturers, or email people that are doing something similar to you, and just like kind of ask for advice, because it's like this huge shortcut. So that was, you know, I think the lifesaver for us is, mm-hmm. A, we had a simple product, but also we kind of just this kind of confluence of things. And the crazy thing, which is like, which we were, eventually we learned that this is definitely not the case, but we went from the Kickstarter ending to shipping all of the product to all the customers in 3 months, which is a ridiculous timeline that like doesn't happen and like it's never fast, happened right? again. Yeah, it's like super fast. So when we were, after we had done that, we're like, oh, this is easy. Like, what are you talking about? And we learned that that is not the case almost ever. But I don't know. It was just kind of the stars aligned with that first product.
So the reason it happened so quickly is because you had already had these relationships and you kind of figured out the process beforehand. You know, I remember... I think I've backed a few things that I still haven't even gotten yet, and it's been a year and a half. I actually need to go check on this. Thanks for that. I would love to know, when developing this product, so Tom, going to you now, was there any like forums that you went to, or like in person, did you like share it with people and get feedback, and how many iterations till you got it to the point where you're like, okay, like this is what the final prototype is going to be like, and let's now go into the molding and the injections, and like, let's get to that phase. Like, how much research was done before actually getting to that point?
Yeah, this is Dan, by the way. That's right. We did. I mean, we were so new at kind of this process, like Tom said, kind of interfacing with manufacturers, that we didn't do a ton of research, or really even like user testing. It was a lot of just kind of gut intuition. We would get 3D prints in the mail from Shapeways and then kind of test them out ourselves, and, you know, get feedback from our, then girlfriends, now wives. And that was kind of pretty much it. And so I think that was another key lesson, is just learning that Kickstarter actually acts as idea validation as well. Is mm-hmm. the two of us were feeling good about it, and you know, the handful of people that we showed it to thought it was cool, but getting all those customers, you know, flooding in on the first day, that was the best kind of, you know, user testing or idea validation we could have asked for. Is just all these people with real money saying, yes, you know, I want that thing. And so then we kind of just scrambled from there. And, you know, in terms of like figuring out how to actually manufacture this thing, we didn't have a choice. It's like, well, we have all these customers now. We better make this happen. So it was kind of an incredible motivator and an instigator to be like, well, there's no turning back now. We got to figure this out. So I think we're really fortunate that, like Tom said, it kind of all the stars aligned and it just went really smoothly for our first campaign, which wasn't always the case in future campaigns.
Yeah. So like, to provide some advice, so now, you know, having done this and kind of, you know, tried some more difficult and more complex products, you know, our development process takes well over a year sometimes, just from, you know, idea to, okay, now's ready for a Kickstarter campaign. Because we've learned that we got really lucky with the glyph. And partially that was because it was so simple functionality. Like, you could describe the whole product in like a single tagline, like completely. So there wasn't a lot of like gotchas there. It was like, okay, you just had to hold your phone securely. So that's like pretty simple. Mm-hmm. But now that we've like, you know, tried at some of these larger and more complex products that have a different value proposition or need to function in some way, we've started doing a lot of that stuff where, you know, we'll make prototypes, we'll get to a point where we're pretty happy with it, and then we'll send it to some kind of beta testers. And so we have friends who we trust where we will make some prototypes that are betas and then send them out to them and try to have them honestly use them and honestly evaluate them. So there's the whole design of the usability side and like market fit, which like Dan mentioned, like Kickstarter super helps. But then there's the whole manufacturing validation, like, okay, can you make this thing? And so the design kind of works in like three phases as we see it. So there's this first like ideation where you have an idea of like what it should be. You kind of bring it to life from your mind and you kind of develop it into something that works and it works pretty well, and it might look good on paper, it might look good in a rendering, and you might have an idea about how it would be manufactured, but you don't know how much it would cost, and it's kind of just this fuzzy thing. And that's good enough where you can send it to people and get feedback, right? But then you have to figure out, okay, like, how do you make this thing, and how much is it going to cost, and then what changes do you need to make to get there? And so for that, we do a lot of, well, A, we've learned a lot over time, so that helps us, but really, like, sending drawings to manufacturers that by the way, we find by just Googling, sending drawings to manufacturers, getting them to like to look at it and talk about it. Like, you can just call them up on the phone and they'll walk through like, oh, this is tricky, this might be expensive, blah, blah, blah. So it's kind of this massaging process where you try to talk to manufacturers, find the suppliers, find the pricing, and then massage the design as you go. Then, you know, you launch it, hopefully with Kickstarter, you get a successful Kickstarter, everything works. But then there's a hidden third design phase, which is after it started being manufactured or you're getting production samples, often there are problems that come up and that requires you to change the design usually. And so there's this, that third process is the thing I think that people really underestimate, especially on Kickstarter. It's their first time. Things are going to go wrong or things are going to be not what you expect. And so learning to be flexible and really have an open communication with your manufacturers, the people making it for you, and doing a lot of prep work to kind of minimize what can go wrong in that kind of third phase.
Yeah, I'm scared. we're still on our first one, and so far things have been going fairly well. And but we are flexible. We're entrepreneurs. We know that that's just part of the process. I'm curious, Dan, can you speak on, like, after your first idea, which kind of just came from a, hey, like, this new product came out, we need this solution, you've done many more products now. Are these just, like, random ideas that come at you, or do you have people pitching you these ideas, or where are these ideas coming from? I'd love to speak on this for the audience who is, you know, physical products sound interesting, but they just don't even know where to start.
Yeah, that's a great question. I see the vast majority of our product ideas come from basically scratching our own itch, kind of finding what we like to say, just like these little frictions in our lives that we think we could design a solution for. So we're basically, selfishly, we're kind of designing products for ourselves. We're designing things that we want and kind of assume that other people want them as well. And then, you know, we can use Kickstarter to validate if that's actually true. Mm-hmm. And so, yeah, we don't really take solicitations of, you know, ideas from just random people. And so initially when we were starting, we were just kind of bouncing all over the place from product category to product category. And that was fun and interesting, but also created some problems. And so I think we've settled down a little bit since then to where we have these kind of genres or like product categories, and we're interested in, you know, building them out a little bit and seeing what happens. So for example, we have kind of like stationery stuff now. We have a notebook and a pen, and we're interested in making more notebooks and more pens to kind of all work together. So we're doing a lot of that stuff now, but we're still always willing, you know, if we get a really exciting idea, we're, you know, we're willing to jump into another product category because that's what we've kind of been doing this whole time. But just to give a specific example that I think is kind of interesting is when we followed up the glyph with our second Kickstarter, which was the Cosmonaut, which was like a wide grip iPad stylus. Mm-hmm. That idea kind of came about. We didn't necessarily think that would be a product. It actually started as a blog post that we wrote that was just like, hey, we think that all these people that are making iPad styluses kind of have it a little bit wrong, and it should be more like a marker instead of like a pen because of the like the low fidelity nature of using an iPad for sketching. Mm-hmm. And so I just like, we made this like crude kind of dry erase marker sized stylus, like a very crude DIY prototype thing. And that blog post kind of took off, like it got some traction, and some kind of influential, you know, Apple bloggers were like, oh, this is like a cool idea. If this was a real product, I would buy it. And I think that kind of inspired us to actually make it into a product. So that was kind of, you know, putting something out in the public and kind of seeing if you can validate the idea, you know, before it even is on Kickstarter. So that was kind of interesting in that case.
Yeah, I love that. The idea of using your platform that you have to kind of just tease different things that you could potentially come up with to gauge interest even before you get on Kickstarter. I love, by the way, the panel book. I mean, that is such a great design, and it just makes sense. So for those of you who don't know, the panel book is another Studio Neat product, which is essentially like a notebook that you keep in front of your computer, but it's shaped in a way that fits like right in front of your keyboard versus the 8.5 by 11 nature of a normal notebook. And just like, you know, like you said, scratching your own itch. And I definitely agree. You kind of have to keep your eyes and ears open for those little frictions. That was the phrase I took away from your presentation in Boise, was like little frictions. And definitely this tool that we're creating for vloggers now is one of those things. And so it like validated the fact that like we are onto something for sure. And of course, now we're in the Kickstarter phase, and I'd love to kind of move into that now. So we talked about the ideation, kind of starting process, design process. Kickstarter, it sounds simple. Put a video up, launch it on Kickstarter, boom, you're done. See if people want it. But obviously, there's a lot more to that. Tom, can you speak on like all the ins and outs and the kind of the hidden like unknowns that we who haven't gone on Kickstarter yet should know about?
Yeah, it's tricky. I mean, it's such a broad world. But if you're making a physical product and launching it, I guess, in the way that we typically do, there are definitely some big pitfalls that we see people kind of fall into a bunch that might not be that obvious. So one thing we see a lot, well, really, I guess like our general, like our biggest tip is to keep things simple, especially if you are starting out. So that can be like what the product is, like keep the product simple, make it small. I would encourage everyone, if you're interested in a physical product and interested in Kickstarter, make the simplest, smallest thing you can and hope and like try to get just 100 backers and then make that thing and ship it to the backers. And what you'll learn is you'll see the full production cycle of like what it means to make and deliver a physical product. And you kind of learn everything. Even if you're only making like 100 of something, you kind of learn the whole thing. And it's like way less risk and it's way easier for you. So keeping it simple, especially when you're starting out, is like huge. That also extends to the like tier, like the rewards. A lot of people will do like stretch goals or stretch rewards where, you know, they have their main product or thing, like goal that they have, like I want to make, you know, sledgehammer, this really awesome sledgehammer. But then there's this kind of this trope on Kickstarter where you have stretch goals where it's like, okay, well, if we get to, you know, $400,000, we can make a green one. Or, if we get to $500,000, we'll give you like this extra spike or something that you can use with your sledgehammer. And that seems like a great idea because it might kind of juice the numbers and help you drive the campaign sum, but it also is very distracting because to make that spike that you're also selling with the sledgehammer might be more complex to make than the sledgehammer. Like it's really difficult to know, especially from the beginning, where the problems will lie and like what happens. And so wouldn't it be a shame to have all these problems and delays and like cost overruns from the kind of add-on things opposed to like the original product you just really wanted to give to people. So we advise people to just like stick with one or two tiers for the reward and keep it just very simple. There's no reason to kind of like goose it. And then Dan, I don't know, can you think of anything else that's like an obvious one? Those are the huge ones. Oh, sorry. I know one more. Do overestimate A, how much time it will take for you to deliver the product to people by like 3 times. So like tell your backers, if you think it's going to take you 6 months, tell them it's going to take a year. Tell them it's going to take 18 months because likely it might. So that's one, like really overpromise or underdeliver. Overpromise and underdeliver. That's what you do, folks. and then the other big thing for like estimating is costs and how much money it will take to fulfill the thing. So one of the hardest parts about physical products is actually the logistics of moving it from you or your manufacturer to the customer. Mm-hmm. So make sure you do your due diligence on how much it costs to ship domestically and how much it costs to ship internationally. Because for us, I mean, 30 or 40% of our backers are typically international backers. And if, you know, if you haven't got those shipping costs right, that can like suck up all your profit real quick. So that's another big one is really kind of do your work in figuring out the logistics part. It's really boring, but it's actually kind of the hardest part of the whole process of getting that to run smoothly. And we still mess that up all the time. It's like a really difficult thing to kind of get right.
So logistics, how would one even begin to figure out how to solve that? And you had mentioned something earlier third-party logistic companies. Dan, can you, like, do you have recommendations, or like where do you find them?
Sure. So that was actually Tom had mentioned Patrick from Dodo Case giving us some advice in our early days, and that was I believe he was the one that pointed us to Shipwire as a fulfillment partner, and we've been using them ever since. Third party logistics like 3PL, you'll see they're kind of all the same in some ways, and there's quite a few of them. Like there's Whiplash is another pretty well regarded one, I think. We're really excited about Black Box, which is that's an offshoot of Cards Against Humanity. They like basically started a fulfillment company. And I want to recommend them specifically because they're doing something really interesting where they're kind of geared specifically towards first-time Kickstarter creators, where they have a kind of soup-to-nuts complete solution for people that are getting into shipping physical products for the first time. So they handle all the shipping, obviously. They handle all the customer service related to shipments. And then they also have kind of like an e-commerce aspect to where if you want to sell your product after your Kickstarter, which I assume most people do, they have this kind of like plug and play checkout button that you can just drop into your website, and that ties to their back end and handles all the fulfillment. So it's really like if Black Box existed when we were starting off, I can't imagine why we wouldn't use them. So that I think they're the only ones that are offering that type of solution where it's just like we handle everything. I mean, I guess that's the name. It's literally a black box. Like they're kind of doing everything behind the scenes. And so, I would give for first time people, I'd give a strong recommendation to them for sure.
Cool. Thank you for that, Dan. Dan, do you have any other thoughts on kind of hidden things in Kickstarter we need to learn about?
Yeah, I think Tom touched on a lot of them. I would say, I mean, to me, it's always about clarity. And so, like, have a short video that's really focused. You know, don't have a ton of reward tiers. Like, try to keep it really simple and really clear. Because I think a lot of people, they want to have all these bells and whistles, or they want to have all these color options, or all these kind of like confusing tier packages. And I think it's really to your benefit for many reasons to just keep things really simple and really clear, because A, it makes it easier for a potential backer to kind of understand what it is you're doing and why you're doing it. But then also for your benefit, you know, like the less SKUs you have or whatever, like the easier it is going to be to make the thing and ship it and everything. So I would stick to that.
Thank you. Yeah, I think this is very common in both the physical and digital space, software especially, where you get this thing called feature creep where you always want to add new things, and it's just like you could, but then it would end up looking like the AT&T U-verse remote with like 100 buttons that nobody uses, right? I'd love a remote control with like four giant buttons, channel up, down, and volume up and down. But going back to the pledge goals, I mean, it's really funny too, because we had even considered multiple colors for the Switch Pod, and it could have been you guys at the conference or other people. Multiple people said, don't get there yet.
Do not.
And you're saying it again, and even multiple sizes, but we're just making it easy. So I'm glad to hear we're on the right path. I'm curious about the pledge goals though, because I've been a part of Kickstarter campaigns where, as a backer, where there are 12 different levels, and you know, the dollar just kind of support you one, all the way up to the, like the $10,000 meet the founders one. And you say just have a few. For a physical product specifically, Thomas, go to you. What would those pledge goals be? Would it simply be the product and then maybe three of that product and that's it? Or like what do those pledge levels look like?
Yeah, so if we had our druthers, we would always just have one thing. We often end up with two or three, and it's because of multiples, like you said, where, you know, you want to buy, like recently, one of our most recent Kickstarters for the Mark 1, this pin, and we had two colors of pin. We had a white one and a black one, and we knew a lot of people would probably want both. And so we had a tier for one, and we had a tier for two, but then we also had a tier for a pin and a pen, a book. And that was just kind of an odd one. And that's, you know, that's just, we wouldn't have guessed that that's the right thing to do, but after doing these campaigns for so long, often people will like message us, oh, hey, what do I do if I want to pledge for two? And you usually have to tell them, oh, okay, we'll add extra money to your thing. We'll figure it out later. It just becomes kind of a logistics problem. So we end up usually having like a tier for two or so if it makes sense for the product. But often, you know, if we could just have one, we would totally just have one. I mean, I think people are coming to your Kickstarter campaign to support you as a human being. And also for your product and the main product, you know, I don't think they, and then they might pick like the one that makes the most sense for them, but I don't know. I don't think that's going to be the thing that pushes them over the edge. However, there's kind of a caveat to this now. So we've been using this thing called BackerKit, mm-hmm. which is a thing that kind of helps, especially if you have a larger campaign, it makes a lot of sense because it kind of sucks all the information out of Kickstarter, and then it helps you kind of get the surveys from people and organize your shipping and logistics. But another thing it does is it provides a space for people to add on to their pledge. And so that's really a great place for someone to add multiples of something. And so now, you know, if someone's like, oh, well, okay, I want a third pin. What do I do? We just say, hey, when we send out the survey, there's going to be a way to do that. So now there's kind of some more technology with BackerKit and some other services, or CrowdOx is another one, where you can kind of, there's more of a way to do that. It used to be that there wasn't really a way, and you'd be like manually entering like something in a spreadsheet, and it was just like pain to keep track of. But mm-hmm. but now there's some better stuff. So, but honestly, like Dan said, you know, I think it's just about simplicity and not like overwhelming people. And one other thing I thought of while Dan was talking that I wanted to make sure and mention about Kickstarter, and something about the video. Obviously, the Kickstarter video is like kind of the thing. It's the thing that people watch. But the thing that I think we always try to remember, and we actually got this note from the very first Kickstarter video we made. We made it, we sent it into Kickstarter, and then they're like, oh, you know what? The thing you guys didn't do was like ask for help. And we realized that really all a Kickstarter video is, if it's done right, it's like you as a human being asking another human being for help across the screen. And so all of our videos always kind of are the same way, where it's like Dan and I sitting on a couch saying, hey, we made this thing. We think you'll like it. And then there's like a little edited series of, this is all the stuff we think is really cool about it. This is what it does. And at the end, we're like, hey, we need your help to make this thing. Honestly, we do. And that's kind of the whole video. And for us, it's true. Like, if we don't get the Kickstarter money, we can't make this thing. It's like straight up honest. Now, there are lots of other ways to use Kickstarter. There's companies who have the product made already. They have VC funding, and they're using Kickstarter as a marketing tool. But for us, it just makes sense. Like, Kickstarter, in its most authentic sense, is like a place where creators ask people for help, ask people on the internet for help. And so we think your video should reflect that, because people really respond to that. They respond to authenticity. And one thing that really proved that to us was on our, you talked about the extra tiers. One of the tiers we had on our first Glyph campaign was, you give us $250 and like we'll have dinner with you in like New York, which is like a weird thing in hindsight that we did. But some amazing stuff came out of that. We had a couple strangers actually like back it and choose that goal. And we went to dinner with them, and it was some, typically it was one time, it was a couple lawyers who like literally wanted to help us. They're like, hey, we just think this is awesome. Like, we want to help you and give you some legal advice. And then the other person was a very wealthy person from the Middle East who was like, hey, I think what you're doing is really awesome. If you ever need, you know, any contacts, blah, 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 let me know. And so I think that only happened. That wouldn't happen if we were like some faceless corporation asking for money. It's mm-hmm. because we were two guys sitting on a couch asking for your help. And so I think that's a really important thing to remember about a Kickstarter video, is it is often just you asking for help. And I think doing that is important.
Thank you for that, Tom. I really appreciate that. Dan, when it comes to getting something up on Kickstarter, like Tom was saying, Kickstarter is, you know, there is some marketing that can happen just by being on that platform. But did you guys do anything more to get the word out there?
Yeah, totally. I think it's a mistake to put a project on Kickstarter and assume that you're finished, you've done all the work. Really, kind of the work begins once your project is on Kickstarter. I kind of liken it to the state of the App Store these days, where you can't just put an app on the App Store and expect it to sell or be downloaded. Like, you have to do marketing and promotion outside of that. And I think Kickstarter is more or less the same way. They probably are better than Apple at like internal promotion, where you can be, you know, like project of the day and things like that. But mm-hmm. really, you have to do your own marketing. So, you know, we've built up, you know, press contacts over the years. Like our very first project for the Glyph was, I mean, I think it literally took off because of one, you know, blog post from John Gruber at Daring Fireball, and then, you know, Gizmodo and all these other places picked it up, and it kind of snowballed from there. So we were really fortunate in that regard. But yeah, you've got to, you know, it's all about outreach. You have to find a way to share it with people that would be interested in sharing it. And kind of like Tom was saying, going back to the authenticity, you know, it can't be PR spam either, because again, at this point, you know, Kickstarter projects are a dime a dozen. You know, what is special about yours? What is interesting about it? Why are you super excited about it? Like, that needs to come through in your pitch. Otherwise, you know, it's just another Kickstarter project. So yeah, that on authenticity and why you're excited about it and why you think it's interesting, it's super important to communicate that.
So Tom, you guys didn't do like a massive ad campaign or like Facebook ads and things like that, or any?
We had, until the last campaign, we had never done any paid advertising for Kickstarter. It was all organic. But cool. we tried out this company called Jellop, J-E-L-L-O-P, which is like dollar spun 180 degrees. But what they do is they do Facebook ads for Kickstarter campaigns, and they come in the last week. So, but they only kind of work with you if you have a somewhat successful campaign and they know you already kind of have some traction. And they come in and they run Facebook ads for you, and then they basically take a cut of whatever they like bring into your campaign. And that was the first time we'd ever done any paid advertising for a Kickstarter campaign. And just it's kind of like an experiment. We didn't put a lot of money into it, but we, you know, tried it out, and it was pretty successful. It was pretty good. I think we ended up like, it was probably like a 30%. It ended up being, after you pay for the advertising and their fee, it was like a 30% roughly like take off of any pledge that we got. And we had the margins to support that. Cool. But sorry, go ahead if you had.
No, I was just saying that's awesome that it was positive ROI.
Oh yeah, definitely. But that positive ROI is the thing that kind of scares me about, like Facebook advertising like that, because I think I would imagine that a lot of companies start doing the Facebook advertising for the Kickstarter, and they start getting down to like, okay, well, we're spending like 50-80% on this ad spend to get this pledge. And at that point, I bet there's almost no product out there that you're going to have the margins to really support that. And the problem is you're not going to find that out until the end. Right.
Right.
And so, especially for first time creators, I would basically just stay away from paid advertising, because Dan and I have done this enough to where we're pretty solid on what our margins, like our end gross margins will be. But it's a really hard thing to know. Things pop up all the time. Mm-hmm. And so it's difficult. And the other thing that is kind of scary about some of that online or like Facebook advertising for Kickstarter is if it blows up, that can actually be really bad. You know, Dan and I, our campaigns are always, you know, between around $200,000. We're happy with that. A couple thousand backers is great. It lets us make the product. If we had a campaign with 50,000 backers, a couple million dollars, it would, even for us, we've done it a lot of times, it would be pretty rough, I think, because the game changes when you're at that level. And so I don't know if, especially when you're doing starting out Kickstarter, that huge growth is what you want. It's like a, I don't know, it's a really risky proposition in my mind.
Yeah, I'd love to talk a little bit more on kind of next steps and the growth of the company and those kinds of things. But before that, I'm just curious, like, Dan, do you guys have any experience with failed campaigns? It sounds like everything has always been like, you know, rainbows and unicorns at this point. But I'm assuming that that's not, because you had hinted at it earlier. What were some of the failures that you've experienced along the way?
Yeah, so we've had one failed Kickstarter campaign to date, and it was for a product called Obi, which was a smartphone-controlled laser cat toy, which is just ridiculous coming out of my mouth. It was that was kind of when we were in our phase of, oh, we can, like, product categories, what product category? Like, we can jump around as much as we want. So up until that point, we had done iPhone accessories and iPad accessories, and then, you know, cocktail tools and iPhone apps. And so we felt like we were kind of jumping around, so we could jump to this other like pet toy category, which, by the way, was like desperately in need of, you know, like a design touch. Almost every pet toy is really bad. And so that's what kind of inspired us to go into that product category. And we think we made, you know, a compelling product, but it just turns out it was a real misalignment with a kind of our existing audience. And we just had a hard time, you know, finding the audience for it. So that campaign failed. It was our most ambitious campaign to date. Our funding goal was like $120,000, and we ended up raising basically half that, like $60,000. And so it wasn't, you know, an abject failure, but it was clear that we just like didn't have the traction to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And so honestly, it was a blessing, because again, the whole idea validation thing is, you know, we could have sunk tens of thousands, hundreds of thousands of dollars in that if we had not had Kickstarter to tell us, you know, no, basically don't make this thing. And so aside from that, I think it was a real, it was kind of a come to Jesus moment for us a little bit as a company, where it's like, okay, we need to like acknowledge our existing audience and think of ways to serve them. So we kind of followed that up with some more, you know, Apple related products, like, you know, we made some iPhone and Apple Watch docks, charging docks and things like that. But even though we've kind of continued to, you know, feel the freedom to jump product categories, like I said, we're doing stationary stuff now, it still feels like a much tighter alignment with our existing audience and our existing fan base than kind of you know, the pet toy, which I think was a little too off, you know, off kilter. So mm-hmm. I really value that moment as kind of a really important moment in the history of our company, even though it felt terrible while it was happening. But I think we came out the other side, so that's good.
Yeah, good for you guys. Tom, after a Kickstarter campaign, obviously you'd want to sell this product and continue to sell it. And you sell it on your website. You have a lot of amazing things to look at studioneat.com. So go ahead and check it out there for all of you listening right now, studioneat.com. You can see a lot of their previous Kickstarter successes now for sale for you, like the panel book and other things like that. But I remember asking you a question. I think it was in the green room before you spoke about, or maybe it was on stage. I can't remember, but it was about the reasons why I don't see these things in retail stores. Like, why don't I go to Target and see the panel book? Why don't I go to, you know, Walmart and see the glyph? Can you speak to why you don't or choose not to kind of go down the retail route and just stick to selling on your own?
Yeah, complex question. I think one of the biggest reasons is we kind of just make products that are a little bit too niche for most retailers. You know, I think some of our things could fit in like a Crate and Barrel or West Elm or something like that. And we've kind of had some of those discussions with those companies before. So that's like one. Like, I think if we had a product that was like awesome for Target, we would maybe put more effort into it. But the thing that ends up happening a lot is there is a huge amount of risk associated with major retail. And being a small company that we are, we often just, it's just like the math never works, right? So, you know, major retailers want pretty large margins, which is pretty standard, but, you know, they want at least a 50% discount, usually a little bit more. And, you know, that works, but works for us typically, but it's just, it's a little bit painful. Mm-hmm. But then when you start talking to them about, okay, well, how much are they going to buy? And then sometimes they want to like validate your factory and, you know, be like, oh, well, hey, we want to like make sure your factory can produce at this quantity, all this stuff. It ends up being like a lot of steps you have to go through. And then you find out, oh, well, they have a buyback program where if we don't sell all your product, you have to buy it back from us. So, you know, it ends up being the situation where, oh, great, let's go to Target. And they're like, okay, great, make 20,000 units for us, okay? And then we'll pay you 90 days later. And if we don't sell them all by like not placing it well or whatever, or it's not a good fit, then you guys have to buy them back from us. So it's just like a lot of risk associated with major retail, and we don't see a lot of upside. Mm-hmm. That's not always the case. Sometimes there's some smaller places, you know, like a Crate and Barrel or something, where they don't want as many units and we could do it, but there's a lot of rigmarole and packaging requirements and things you kind of have to go through. And really, we've decided to set ourselves up for e-commerce really well. So we have our own website that's like direct to consumer. So, you know, you go on there, it ships from our warehouse directly to you. It's great. We have a good customer relationship there. Then we also do, you know, sometimes half of our revenue is on Amazon.com. And for us, that's kind of our wholesale channel. Mm-hmm. So it's not wholesale, but it feels that way. So Amazon takes like 30-ish%, and we use their Fulfilled by Amazon program. So it's really cool because people with Amazon Prime get free shipping on our stuff. So, you know, we just send bulk inventory to Amazon. They put it in their warehouse. They distribute it all over the country, so it will ship quickly. And then, you know, they literally handle the customer service. They handle everything after that. And so for us, that's where it makes sense to us. Like, we can have our branded personal experience on our website. And if someone is like wanting something quick, or they are just browsing Amazon or whatever, they can go through Amazon. So for us, that's kind of fitting the bill for us instead of major retail. And honestly, you know, we have a little like mastermind Slack group with a bunch of other companies that are like similar to us. And none of them have had a good experience doing major retail. I think we're just too small. Honestly, I just don't think we have the infrastructure and the like scale to do it well. It's really hard. It's really tricky.
Well, even if you did, it's like, you know, initially, when I think about physical products, I'm like, the dream is to get into like a Walmart, or the dream is to get into Target and just have it be in like tens of thousands of people's hands. But then, like you were saying, like the logistics and just like, is that what you really want? I mean, it's just that was the dream, I think, for a lot of people. But now with the internet and the tools that we have access to and the experiences that we could give our customers on a much more deeper level, like maybe that's not even a thing that you would want anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so. I mean, so we have a friend company, Lumi, and they're like design a U line. They're really cool. So if you ever want custom packaging or anything, go to Lumi.co, L-U-M-I. But before that, they made this thing called IncoDye, which was basically this really cool way to do like screen printing and then have it be sun activated and stuff on shirts and leather. But so they built their whole business where they did their own in-house manufacturing, and they like went full on, like, we're going to be in Hobby Lobby, Michaels, like all. And they were in every like, you know, craft store around the country, but they had to have a huge sales team to pull that off. I mean, it was like a big deal. And so they walked away from that eventually because it was just too hard to deal with the like net 90-day terms. And it's just like they had huge cash flow problems dealing with these large retailers because they, you know, they're a huge corporation. They're like, what do you mean? Why is $30,000 a big deal? It's like, no, it's a huge deal for us. So it's just like, it's kind of playing the wrong game. And, you know, for us, the way we think about our business is, you know, we let the big companies make these big products and we fill in the gaps. We don't need to sell, you know, 100,000 of a product for it to make sense to us. We can sell 5,000, 10,000. It's a great product. And so we do the things that our large companies just won't do because it's too niche or whatever. So we're super happy being where we are. I mean, we don't have any aims to like, you know, go clobber any big company. It's like, what's the point? They make boring stuff anyways.
I love that line of thinking, Tom. Thank you for that. And Dan, I'd love for you to help finish this off by talking about your team and the size of it. I was very surprised to learn who was all involved with the amazing business that you have. Can you share and reveal like the size of your team, Dan?
Yeah. So as Tom was talking, I did want to clarify, because I don't think we actually mentioned it, is our company Studio Need is literally just the two of us. Just the two of us, and so we don't have a sales team or anything like that. So that obviously plays into, you know, not doing these retail things and such. Right. And yeah, just being the two of us it's been a very, conscious decision of kind of company we want to be. And, you know, in our hearts, we're both designers and we just love making new products. And we've kind of, by, you know, trial and error over the years, realize that the best way to do that is to just, you know, kind of stay small, keep things simple. And you know, the formula we have, it seems to have illustrated that we can have repeated success by just kind of like doing the same process over and over again. So our current plan is just to keep doing that for as long as we can. And it's not like we're anti-growth or anything like that, but we're definitely anti-growth for growth's sake. And so we're trying to be kind of very organic and, you know, take things slow. and be just totally satisfied with it just being the two of us. So it's been working great so far. I guess this will be our next month will be our 8th year anniversary of being in business. So
yeah,
we're going to kind of keep, thank you. We're going to keep going as long as we can.
I mean, that's really inspiring to hear, because I think a lot of us just feel like we have to keep growing and going bigger. And we often forget about, like, okay, well, why did we get into this in the first place and what actually makes us happy? And it's so cool to see a company that's been around for so long stick to that, and you're doing amazing things, you're creating amazing products, and you're both happy. I mean, it's awesome.
Yeah, I mean, just like behind the curtain, I'm sitting in my home office, so is Dan. We both made choices to not have a space. We wanted to work from home to be close to our kids and not have like the overhead and all that stuff. Mm-hmm. But also, you know, that doesn't mean that we don't want to grow revenue-wise. Like, the really amazing thing about the way we set up our company is we could, you know, we could sell 10 times as much product next year and literally nothing would change. Because all of our warehousing, fulfillment, manufacturing, everything is outsourced. So when an order comes into our website, it goes straight to one of our warehouses. We have one in LA, one in the UK, and then it gets shipped out to the customer the next day. And so that could happen at a way faster rate and doesn't really change us at all. And so we are really optimizing to outsource stuff and keep it really simple and keep it focused what we're on. And I think we're actually in a really good position for the future, because I think the future for physical products is all about niche. You know, it's going to be, like you said, you can be a small team and reach so many people. You can build this really niche product, like for vloggers. You could reach all the vloggers in the world pretty easily. And that's a huge, big market. And it's like, you know, you could be one person to reach all of the people. So for us, it feels like we're set up for the future, because all the things that are hard right now are going to get easier. So manufacturing is going to get easier. Logistics are going to get easier. Outreach, like advertising, is all going to get easier. And if we keep on our toes and keep leveraging technology to really kind of extend ourselves, I feel like we can grow from a revenue point of view. There's like no limit, really. It feels good. I mean, it feels like we're in the right spot. And I would encourage anyone who's interested in that. I mean, you know, just keep it slow and don't, there's another way to do it. And if you haven't read Rework by like 37 Signals, Jason Fried, check out that book. That's been really amazing, helpful though, to us. Yeah. And just knowing that, you know, the stories you hear about how businesses are run is not the only way. You know, you can do it your own way.
Guys, you guys are amazing. Thank you so much for coming on and giving us inspiration today. It's been extremely helpful for me. And again, thank you so much for all the help you've given me and Caleb toward whatever the end results are going to be for the Switch Pod. I'm just really excited.
It'll be great.
Thank you, man. Thank you. Dan, where can people go to find more info and check out your products?
Yeah, I mean, you said it before, just studioneat.com is the is our website where you can check out all our products. We have a weekly newsletter called The Gazette if you're kind of interested in hearing from us on a more frequent basis. And we also have a podcast called Thoroughly Considered over at relay.fm. So yeah, lots of places to hear more of us if you're interested in that.
I love it. And Tom, any, you know, 1 minute for a final piece of inspiration for everybody.
Just do it. I mean, honestly, I think if you're sitting there and you want to make a physical product, like, I'm serious, start something small. Make something you can sell to 50 people and put it on Kickstarter. Kickstarter projects don't have to be big. And you will learn so much by just going through that full process of making and delivering a product to someone. And if you like it, you'll just keep going. You can do bigger next time. But that, I think you can do it. I mean, Dan and I are a bunch of dummies. We don't know anything about business. We make our decisions on our gut, what feels right, and we just try to do it the right way, and like, you can totally do it too.
Yeah. Love you guys. Thank you so much for coming on. Appreciate you.
Yeah, thank
Thanks.
You.
Thanks for having us.
All right, I hope you enjoyed that episode with Tom and Dan from Studio Neat. You can find them at studioneat.com and all the amazing products there. If you want to check out the show notes and get links to all their other resources, the products that were mentioned, unfortunately that cat laser thing is not available. But I can see why it didn't make sense for them to continue to put more resources into that or try again, because they've really honed in on what they do, how they do it. It's just so interesting that they've stuck with a small team, yet they've been incredibly successful. So hopefully some encouragement for you, especially as you hear a lot of these business owners continue to grow and build and scale with large teams. You don't have to do that. And I think that's a big lesson there that is one of the many takeaways in this episode. So if you want to check out the show notes, all you have to do is go to smartpassiveincome.com/session344. Once again, smartpassiveincome.com/session344. If you haven't yet listened to the episode with me and Caleb talking about the beginnings of our invention and how we put it together, you can find that in the latest episode on your device or smartpassiveincome.com/session343. Anyway, thanks again. I appreciate you. Make sure you hit subscribe if you haven't already. We got a lot of great episodes and information and encouragement and motivation coming your way. And a big shout out to everybody who has recently left a review for the show as well. It's just so meaningful to me and it motivates me to keep going, keep creating for you because I'm here to serve you. So keep up the great work. Thanks. And I'll see you the next episode. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Smart Passive Income Podcast at www.smartpassiveincome.com.
Entrepreneurs, what is the smart way to save when your growing business takes you on the road? Whether you're going to events or conventions or you're speaking somewhere, no matter what it is, you need to sign up for a free membership with Hertz Business Rewards. Yep, Hertz Rental Car created a program to help small and mid-sized businesses save money. Work trips, client meetings, industry conferences. With Hertz Business Rewards, you save at least 20% every time you rent a car. And you'll save on more than just the daily rate. Members earn credits redeemable toward free rental days, and it's also free to add an additional driver if any additional coworkers come along. And for those Gen Z entrepreneurs out there, no young renter fees. Plus, sign up for Hertz Business Rewards today and earn 3x credit during your first 90 days. These benefits add up to big savings that stack more dollars in your wallet. Join for free at hertz.com/businessrewards. Applies to base rate, taxes, fees, and options excluded. Additional terms and exclusions apply. Visit hertz.com/businessrewards to learn more. Starting a business can feel daunting and confusing, but it doesn't have to be. That's why Terry Rice started the Launch Your Business podcast, another awesome show from the Entrepreneur Podcast Network. Each week, Terry shares strategic actions, specific tools, and what he refers to as high-performance mindsets that allow you to thrive under pressure. Recent guests include rapper T.I., Amy Porterfield, and yours truly. And Terry frequently publishes value pack solo shows too, like this one titled How to Write Proposals That Get Accepted and Don't Take Forever to Write. Great stuff. So make sure you listen in to Launch Your Business right now on Apple Podcasts, Google, Spotify, or Stitcher.